is invited to go back to our breathing, and our collective energy of mindfulness bring us together as an organism, going as a river with no more separation. But the whole Sangha breathes as one body, generates peace as one body, keeps free as one body. Let us transcend the boundaries of a delusive self, liberating from the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex.
So why does one seek a spiritual path? There's obviously something going on in you. Some sort of discomfort, some sort of disillusionment, some sort of yearning, some type of suffering, some type of confusion. That is seeking a resolution in some way or the other. So you encounter a path, and usually in the beginning you're propelled by kind of an intellectual curiosity about it, and you read about it, and if you find that it is intriguing or it has some answers to you, you become more familiar with it, and usually that is you begin to study its basic tenets. Right? And you entering the Buddhist path, you'd be studying the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Three Marks of Existence, the Twofold Emptiness. You'd be perhaps reading about Bodhicitta and the path of the Bodhisattva, compassion, loving kindness, the Four Immeasurables. Right? You'd kind of get a map. A guidebook of the path. And then some people go that far. And going that far gives them some level of satisfaction, remediates some of their dissatisfaction or confusion to some extent, and that's enough. But like was said the other day, some people having the map and having the guidebook and seeing the pictures is not enough. And they want to go to Paris themselves. Walk the streets, smell the smells, eat the food, meet the people, speak the language. But to do that, one has to move in the direction of direct experience. And so we undertake, at that point, a more engaged form of practice. We practice mindfulness. We learn to live in the present moment without a lot of distraction, without a lot of conceptualization. We learn, how can I be at peace? How can I be at ease just in all the unfolding moments of my life? Right. Well, for some people, learning the basics of mindful living and mindfulness is also a positive step in their life and brings them a certain levels of peace and calmness and greater equanimity in their life. And they're happy with that. That's enough for them. But some people, either because they're intrigued by what they have read from the Buddha, from the masters, about enlightenment, about awakening, about liberation, about freedom from suffering, about non-duality, etc., etc., are intrigued, are caught, and they want to go have deeper experiences, right? Or else the practice of mindfulness does not remediate their suffering enough, does not remediate their egocentricity enough, does not remediate their narcissism enough, and the smell of all that still nauseates them a bit. And for many of us, it's a combination of the two that moves us along. So then we move into practices and teachings that the masters and the Buddhas have all followed, which is the path of samatha, single-pointed concentration, samadhi, and vipassana, insight. We want to go deeper. Not because we're high achievers. Some people, you know, we're high achievers. You know, oh, is that the toughest course? That's for me. Is that what a BA, PhD in Buddhist practice is? Well, that's for me. I always, you know. Not because of that, hopefully, but because we want to be free. We want to be happy. And perhaps we also really want to be of benefit to others, and we know that as long as we have not liberated ourselves and freed ourselves and still being dragged around by our conditioning, by our reactive formations, by ourselves, and we don't know how to really stop that, how can we really help others stop their suffering, who are suffering the same way? So, at that point, we get a little more serious about meditation practice. Right? And we begin to try to be more concentrated, more focused in our meditation. And then we come to what we've come to in this retreat. Insight. Understanding. No longer are we satisfied with just an intellectual understanding of the teachings of impermanence, composite nature of things, dukkha, the suffering inherent in all composite things. No longer do we want just an intellectual understanding of the five skandhas. We want to experience what they are, because they are readily apparent to us, right, if we look deep enough. But again, it's all in the service of deepening our understanding, why, of reality, of ourself, why, so we can be free, so we will no longer be attached, so we'll no longer be addicted, so we'll no longer be dragged around by our nose because we don't understand clearly the nature of reality, the nature of things, the nature of phenomena, the nature of self, the nature of mind. Right, all those things. Right, we want to take the fog away. Or as it said in the teachings, we want to remove the veil of delusive conceptualization and thought, misperceptions, and we want to remove the veil of emotional affection, which create heaviness. If you feel a heaviness in your heart, if you feel a heaviness in your mind, if you don't feel light and free and natural, it is because the weight of afflictive emotions and the weight of conceptualization and misperception is weighing us down. It is hanging heavy on our true nature. So in the last few days, we have begun to take a more deeper look at what Buddhist psychology posits as the five aggregates of a being. Right. We've looked into body and mind. And we've looked to see, are they solid things or are they just composites? Are they permanent or impermanent? Are they the basis of unending happiness, or do they contain the basis for suffering? But the last insight, and somebody asked me a question about that, of self and the I, for each of us is the key. That is the fundamental delusion which is causing us to suffer. And it is the fundamental delusion that can actually be penetrated and experienced directly without the mediation of intellect. Okay? In Buddhism, we talk about the twofold emptiness, the emptiness of objects and the emptiness of self. The emptiness of objects is not as readily apparent to us directly. Right? Because things appear to us to be solid and self-existent. But through analysis, right, as we have done here, we can see and we can understand that they are just composite parts. Right? We can break everything down into that composite parts, and even the composite parts we can break down into composite parts ad infinitum, until finally we realize there is nothing of solid anywhere. Well, as everything is characterized by impermanence and change, that is something that we can observe and understand. But in terms of self, the I, the me, the mine, that profound and fundamental misconception which keeps the whole ball rolling, that can be directly, intuitively apprehended through meditation, through Vipassana. That is why that liberation, that insight, is transformative. When you read the life of the Buddha, when you read the life of the great meditation masters, they refer to experiences of enlightenment, experiences of insight. That means they are having a direct experience of something which is transformative. Now, you know, there are all different degrees of insight. And from the degrees of insight, there are all different degrees of transformation that come from that insight. Little, big. But this is the path that the Buddha masters have followed. And I will be reading from Master Gosui this morning to share the way a great awakened master in the Japanese Zen tradition put it together. So if ego creates itself, who is it that created the ego? Who is having this experience? What is the difference between a yogi and a Buddha? Again, in a certain way, you know, when you somebody asked a question about deconstructing thoughts using composite as a composite and as a non-self. Again, all phenomena, right, physical or mental, right, are composites. Right? But you know, very few, unless they're highly diluted, impute a self to a flower. Right? Imputing selves is usually something human beings do. Right? So it's kind of an extra add-on that we do. Because we think, you know, we're quite willing to accept that this flower is made up of parts, and that all these parts, you know, are connected to earth and water and air and seed, etc., and that it's only causes and conditions that are maintained in its form and cause the conditions to change or will change, right? So we are quite willing to accept the composite nature of most phenomena, except we believe, right, that there is something that stands outside the composite nature of ourselves, that is a me, that is a Fred, that is an I. There is something else here, right? Because we will talk about what? My body. My body parts. We might even talk about what? My skandhas. Yes, I have 5 skandhas. Yes. Yes, I have a body. Yes, I have a mind. Yes, my mind is empty. Yes, my body is empty. Right? Well, what is that I that seems to own all this? Now, one might say that that's, you know, an interesting intellectual or philosophical or psychological issue that may, you know, for those of such bent may want to think about. But it is much more pernicious about that. Because this fundamental misperception that somehow seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, feeling, thinking, feeling, memory, all the processes of the mind, somehow there is an entity, right, that owns all this, that is different than everything else. There's an inside and there's an outside. And inside is me. And everything around this belongs to me. And anything outside that I can claim also is mine. Right? And we know, for those of you who've had children, or those who remember being a child, or those of you who've got up inside or have studied child development, we know that one thing Western psychology has been done very good at is, cataloging that developmental process. Right? Of separation individuation. And the development of self, from infancy, through the terrible twos, and on up as the higher cognitive processes are developed. That self, and what it claims as it, gets larger and larger and larger. And as it goes through, more and more experiences over time, the mental formations around which it has created its own self-identity becomes more elaborated. Right? It becomes a much more complex kingdom that each of us have to advance and defend. And we end up being fairly imperialistic. Right? We not only want to protect and hold on to what we got, but we also are always looking over the boundaries of our little kingdom to see what else we can get. How can I extend my empire? Right? Who can I claim? What more objects can I get? More money, more power, more people, more liking, more medals, more things. More status, more love. Why is that self insatiable? It is never satisfied, is it? No. You give it one thing, it's only happy. It's like a child, right? Like you give a child a new toy, it's happy for a few days, a couple of weeks. After a while, it throws the toy down, wants another toy. Right? We're like, always dissatisfied. Our satisfaction is short-lived. Why? Because that self that is motivating this attachment, acquisition, this yearning, etc., etc., can never be satisfied because it is not real. It only defines itself by what it accumulates, what it controls, what it has. Left to its own devices, it is what? It is sad. It is lonely. It is empty. It is unfulfilled. It is dissatisfied. So it always has to constantly create drama, action, activity. Right? Why do people find it so hard to be alone? Because being alone is not happy. Because the self has nothing to play with, to stimulate it. Now, if that was something we were stuck with, right, that could be just something we have to adjust to, right? And basically, if you look at the traditional Western psychology, that's what Western psychology is about, right? Helping the ego adjust. Right. The height of mental health is what? A well-adjusted ego. Right? That is helpful. If you accept that the state of egohood, right, of selfhood, is the way, the truth, the way it is. But what the Buddha discovered in his introspection, in his contemplation, in his meditation, right, was that this was not true. The house is empty, he said. Right? The house. Right. This is the house. These are the windows. I know these are the windows and the doors, all our senses. The Buddha looked into the house, and he could find nothing. No thing, including the self. And you might say, but I feel like there's something in here, right? I feel like there's something in here. Just like I feel that's solid and real, right? Just like I feel this is solid. So, because we feel something or we see something that appears a certain way, unless we look more deeply, right, into it, we will be fooled. So, we have to, but if you want to be free of this self-imposed individuation, which keeps you feeling separate from, disconnected from everything. When I say everything, I mean everything. One has to follow a path that frees us from this fundamental delusion. Well, luckily, it's not that hard to do. But it is hard to get up enough determination and energy and interest to go about doing this. Right? We know that people do incredible things, right? People are climbing Mount Everest without oxygen. Right? People do all kinds of things these days. Right? People go through Marine boot camp. And they go off and, run around with 120-pound packs and kill each other and put themselves in great danger. Right? Because they believe in something. Right? People want to be triathlon, whatever, and they just train hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours, don't they? Yeah. They put themselves through all kinds of deprivation to achieve what they want. Right? People go to medical school for 5,000 years, right? And put them through that. Because why? Because they have there's something they want to attain, there's something they want to realize. So, I could go on and on, but we all know, and maybe there are many people here, when there is something that really we are intrigued by, something we want to accomplish, we are quite willing to be very energetic, to be very disciplined, right, aren't we? and to deprive ourselves, right? I mean, I would imagine during the course of your training, of medical school, of residency, that you deprive yourself of lots of the ordinary activities and pleasures of ordinary people, right? Because you had to. Because you had a goal and there was no time. But heaven forbid you should tell people that, you know, your social time is being limited these days because you really want to come to realization. you're like you're nuts, you know. I'm going to devote myself single-mindedly the next 5 or 10 years to becoming a Buddha. Right? So I won't be able to make happy hour the way I used to. people go, what happened to Fred? He used to be such a normal guy. Right? But if you say, no, I can't make happy hour because I'm training for a triathlon, they go, oh, good for you. Right? I mean, there have been other societies, as we know, other cultures. We're having an aspiration for awakening, having an aspiration for transformation, having an aspiration to heal and transform yourself so you can benefit others. And if you told people that, they would actually support you. They would actually support you. You know? Oh, you want to go off and do that? Can I contribute to your stay in retreat? Can I contribute to your stay at the monastery? Right? Anyhow. This is where we're at. So let me... I'm reading from the Three Pillars of Zen. Three Pillars of Zen. It's funny. Opening this book, it was quite. my first. Theravada Kapapa, Philip Kapil Roshi was my first teacher. I spent 7 years with him, and in those days, the Three Pillars of Zen was the Bible. This was the book. So picking it up again, it's quite an experience. After many years, it's still a wonderful book. If you go back to people who practiced Zen, but not only Zen, really other Buddhist practices back in the late 60s and 70s and into the 80s, this was one of the seminal books. Because this was maybe the first book that described practice. You know, those were the days of Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki and there was lots of intellectual stuff, deep Zen, that was written about it. But nobody wrote about Zazen. Nobody wrote about meditation. Nobody wrote the actual practical things of what Zen practitioners, actually do. This book delineated very clearly what the practice was about, how to do the practice, as well as it had whole sections on interviews between teachers and their students, so people got an idea, what the interchanges are like. And also had a first-hand accounts of modern alive people who had the various degrees of enlightenment experiences. So it showed that the tradition of awakening was still alive, and that ordinary people, housewives, businessmen, insurance adjusters, artists, that are a Canadian housewife, if they devoted themselves to the practice, could have these type of experiences. So also in the book there are other things, but one of the things I want to share with you is some teachings and writings by not that well known, actually, Zen teacher from the 14th century, Basui, B-A-S-S. UI, again, live in the 14th century. And just by way of introduction, basically what's in here is a sermon he gave. There's really not very much writings, I guess, extant by him. There's a sermon here and some letters. Again, please remember, this is the 14th century. There was no telephones, no video conferencing, and things were quite distant. So it didn't mean that students did not travel to see their teacher, but it might be rare because of the distance involved. So people wrote letters. They would write letters to their teacher about their practice, about their questions, and he would write back. Obviously, someone collected the letters that he wrote. Well, I'm not sure how that happened, actually. So I don't know. Well, it doesn't say whether his attendant or something made copies of all the letters before he sent them out, because I'm sure they didn't have a copy paper in those days. So, but somehow somebody, maybe after his death, somebody collected the letters. But in one of the letters to a monk in Shobo Hermitage, he wrote a little bit about his life. So I wanted to share that with you to give a sense of who he was, to see how he, before we go into how he taught. And this is a letter to a monk in Shobo Hermitage, so I would imagine this is a monk who is in retreat, and it says, at his urgent request. And I don't know what the request was, but he writes, this is what he writes. He says, this is Basui. He says, in my boyhood, this question perplexed me. Aside from this physical body, what replies, I am so-and-so, when asked, who are you? Interesting. At that age. Right? He had an understanding. When somebody says, who are you? And I say, I'm Fred. That it's not just the body, right, that is responding. There is something else that seems to know and knows to respond. So he was perplexed by that. The perplexity having arisen, it became deeper year by year, resulting in my desire to become a monk. Then I made this solemn vow. Quote, now that I have determined to be a monk, I cannot search for truth for my own sake. Even after winning the supreme truth, I will defer full Buddhahood until I have saved every sentient being. Now, that's quite a vow for a teenager. Those of us remember what we were concerned with when we were teenagers, it certainly was not searching for enlightenment in order to liberate all sentient beings. But he was willing to defer full Buddhahood. And furthermore, he said, until this perplexity has been dissolved, I will not study Buddhism or learn the rituals and practices of a monk. I mean, for most people, it's the other way. First, they become a monk, and they do rituals and practices and study. He says, right, so long as I live in the human world, I will stay nowhere except with great Zen masters and in the mountains. So this is kind of an extraordinary being, even at a young age. But his thirst to know who he was, right? You know, I'm a body, but and the mouth says, right, my name is Fred, but if I'm dead, you can still see my mouth, as you ask me, is your name Fred? I won't say anything. So there's something else going on. What is that? And he obviously wasn't looking for intellectual answers. I mean, somebody could say, oh, that's just you. Oh, okay. Or, that's your mind. Oh, okay. Those are just words. He wasn't satisfied. You know, he wanted, again, you know, he wanted real food. You couldn't just give him a picture of food or name of food. Right? So at some point, obviously, he says, after I entered a monastery, my perplexity increased. At the same time, a strong resolve arose from the bottom of my heart, and I thought, Shakyamuni Buddha has already passed, and Maitreya, the future Buddha, has not yet appeared. During this period when authentic Buddhism has declined to the point where it is about to expire, and this is a certain thing in the Lotus Sutra and that kind of delineates these 500-year periods from the time of the Buddha, things were just supposed to degenerate. So, obviously at that time, he believed they were in one of the ages when Buddhism might disappear from the human world. So during this period, when authentic Buddhism has declined to the point where it's about to expire, may my desire for self-realization, capital S, be strong enough to save all sentient beings in this Buddhaless world. Even should I suffer the pangs of everlasting hell as a result of this sin of attachment to saving all sentient beings. I think somewhere he read, you know, in Buddhists we don't attach. He said, I'm attached. I want to help people. And even if this, you know, has serious afterlife repercussions, that's okay. So long as I can shoulder the sufferings of sentient beings, I will never become discouraged or forsake my eternal vow. Furthermore, in practicing Zen, I will not idle away my time thinking of life and death or waste even a minute in trifling good works. Nor will I blind others to the truth by trying to minister to them so long as my own spiritual strength is insufficient to lead them to self-realization. This is a great theme, isn't it? Uncompromising. So he says, you know, I am going to be single-mindedly focused, and we'll find out in a minute what he's single-mindedly focused, how he goes about that. But I'm not going to waste my time in idle chatter and thinking of philosophical issues about life or death, or even get involved in trifling good works, which hits home to some of us who may find that we spend some of our time in trifling good works. He said, I'm not even gonna help people, even with the Dharma, until I have the true capacity to lead them to realization, to freedom. Yeah? Until I've realized that for myself, I'm not even going to really do any teaching. And supposedly that was really the way he did. He really stayed away from monasteries. He really stayed in the mountains. He'd only spent one night when he visited places. It wasn't until late in life that he actually, as people begged him, asked him, offered him, that he actually got his own monastery. And supposedly at the end, at least in the introduction, it says it became quite large. He had 1,000 disciples, monastic and lay, and became quite an enterprise. But you can see why. He was quite a person. It sort of reminds me when he says, nor will I blind others to the truth. Isn't that interesting? You know, you'd think, well, at least you could help people a little bit. You know, that would be helpful. He says, nor will I blind them to the truth. He was saying, if I don't know the truth, then I my teachings and efforts may just be making them more confused. I will refrain from opening my big mouth until I really know what I'm talking about. It sort of reminds me of, there's that great interchange between Milarepa and Kampopa. Milarepa was this great yogi, great enlightened master. Wonderful story. People probably know the story. I won't go into it. But he really a very wonderful, very intriguing, very interesting story of a human being. Started out as a black magician, and all kinds of intrigue with his families, and killed people with making hailstorms, and had a very lively, very strong, this type of teacher named Marpa, who put him through the mill. Did not give him an inch, made him suffer uncontrollably. But he never, he always paid homage to Marpa. But anyhow, Milarepa spent most of his life meditating in the high Himalayas with just a cotton robe and was a great yogi. Anyhow, there's an interchange. Gampopa, who was actually a physician, had come to live near him. Up in caves and was practicing. And at some point, Gampopa came to Milarepa and said, I'm concerned about people down in the valley. I'm concerned about people down in the valley. There's so much suffering there. There's so much delusion. People just, unhappy, dissatisfied. They don't know the path to liberation. I want to go down and help them. Huh? So you think Milarepa said, go, my son. Help sentient beings. And the Lord said to him, he said, "Can't cope with my son. You need to decide whether you want to be a little light in this world or whether you want to be a great light in this world." Because if you're just a little light, if you're a one candle, two candle, you may be only able to help, a few people to lead them out of darkness. Because you have a little light. Right? But the world needs great lights. Bright shining lights. That can lighten up the road, the path, for hundreds, thousands. My son, be a great light. And Gimpopa, of course, stayed with his teacher for more time, more practice. So he makes these resolutions. I've even not idle away his time thinking of life or death. I waste even a minute in trifling good works, and will I blind others to the truth by trying to minister to them so long as my own spiritual strength is insufficient to lead them to self-realization. These resolutions became part and parcel of my thinking, even bothering me to some extent in my meditation. But I could not do otherwise. I constantly prayed to Buddha, to the Buddhas, for strength to carry out these resolutions, which I made the standard of my conduct in both favorable and unfavorable circumstances. Thus it has been up to the present. So that's a little about the Sui in his own words. And now I'll begin to read from the sermon. Again, I'm sharing these teachings of the Sui with you is to just show you another way that Vipassana, the path of insight and understanding, the path to understanding the nature of reality, right? The impermanent non-self nature of reality, the empty nature of reality, the wheel of meditation investigation that we just read from Nipa Rinpoche is one approach, and this Zen way is another approach. But it's all really the intent is the same. So this is his sermon. And I'll just read parts of it, and then your time will read a little from some of the letters. Think of a flavor of how he taught. It's interesting, Kapo's, he ends his introduction saying, "It is hoped that this translation, the first into English, those who read it will find, that these translations, the first in English, will find equal favor with English-speaking readers eager to understand and practice it." So this is the sermon. He begins. "If you would free yourself of the sufferings of birth and death, you must learn the direct way to becoming a Buddha. This way is no other than the realization of your own mind." Capital M. So this is called the direct path. Other paths move in the direction of realization, step by step, stage by stage, in a graded way. But now he's teaching the direct path. my own Dzogchen teacher would say, if you want to go to Delhi, we were up in Dehradun, so if you want to go to Delhi, right, you can walk, you can take a bicycle rickshaw, you can take a horse-drawn cart, or you can take a taxi, you can take a train, or you can fly. You will get to Delhi with each of those ways. It's your choice. If you would free yourself of the sufferings of birth and death, you must learn the direct way to become a Buddha. This way is no other than the realization of your own mind. This is important. Your own mind. You already have it. You already own it. It's not something foreign to you. Now, this is important. His next sentence is, now what is the mind? Okay? This is, again, in Zen, I think in any path to realization, happen to be in the Zen tradition now. One needs three things. So I wonder if those are the three pillars of Zen. Teaching, that's teaching practice enlightenment. You know, Buddhism has three of this and five of this. You can mix up. Anyhow. The first thing one needs is faith / trust. Right? Like when you chant every day verses on the faith mind, but that's also could be translated as the trust. Trust. So what do we have to have faith in? This. That each of us have this original Buddha mind, unsullied, totally present now. And he'll get something. But this, again, this has to be something that we either have faith in or we trust is true. I say that because, again, it is not our experience, is it? It is the experience of the Buddhas and the masters. We have to trust and have faith that this is true, because this motivates us to want to move in that direction. If we don't have that, right? So when I come back and I tell Jim all about Paris, I don't know why I'm going on about Paris today, right? And I tell Jim, Paris, it's incredible, right? You've got to go, Jim. It'll change your life, right? Now, Jim's never been to Paris, right? Has he? So he doesn't know what I'm talking about, right? Jim's never been out of Land O'Lakes, as far as I know, right? So he goes, well, what's this? And they speak, you know what I mean? So he's going to have to what? For him to go. For him to start, saving his money and working up and getting a passport, right, and all that, right? He's going to have to what? Trust that I'm not putting him on, right? That I'm not making it up, that I'm not over-embellishing, right? There's got to be trust. So this is an article of trust. Now, again, it's not, because there are accounts of, as well as it's a living tradition, it's not all that difficult, right? Remember, at the time of the Buddha, everyone who encountered the Buddha encountered a living being. And it was very clear in his presence, right? and very clear in the way he taught, and that he was awake. So therefore, we know that he had a tremendous capacity, because if you read the sutras and teachings, you hear what? At the end of such and so attained the first level of arhatship, or the first level of bodhisattvaship. And why could that be? Because of his power, right? Now, 2,500 years have passed. But still, there is a living tradition of awakening. And we see the power of the teachings, the power of the practices to transform people that look just like us. Right? So we can have faith in it, that when they tell us something, it is true. So we have to trust that. We have to have faith in that. Right? That each of us are Buddhas, meaning we all have that Buddha nature. A Buddha is someone who is awakened to their own nature. That's what he's saying. One's own nature. Not somebody else's nature. Not something outside of our own experience. Not something outside of our own mind. What is Buddha mind? Ordinary mind is Buddha mind. Like this. Second, one has to have what he just did. One has to have some degree of doubt. So the first thing one has to do is have this faith, trust, that we have this original nature. And the second is we have to have some kind of question to motivate. Right? So he goes, there is no other way than the realization of one's own mind. Then the question, what is mind? There are lots of questions. Right? If I'm a Buddha, why don't I know it? Right? If all sentient beings are inherently Buddhas, but why do they act so terribly to one another? Right? Who am I? What am I? Where do thoughts come from? Right? What is my mind? One needs to have that kind of questioning mind that will motivate us to what? One has faith in one's true nature, and one kind of is using a kind of questioning investigative procedure, the vipassana, to get there. See, the third is determination. So if one has the trust that one has, the different ways of saying the trust. One has the trust in one's capacity to be free, to be liberated, to be free of suffering, et cetera, self free of suffering. One has trust in that, trust in the Dharma. The question kind of motivates us to peel away the layers, and then we have to, you put them together, and you have the determination to realize. Right. Not to stop and pull. So, if you would free yourself of the sufferings of birth and death, you must learn the direct way to become a Buddha. This way is no other than the realization of your own mind. Now, what is mind? It is the true nature of all sentient beings, that which existed before our parents were born and hence before our own birth, and which presently exists, unchangeable and eternal. So it is called, one's face before one's parents are born. It's a famous face. Right? Face is a capital F. We all know what this face is. But what was our original face before our parents are born? It's pointing us to what? beyond time, right? What is my essential nature? That was there before birth, before my parents were born, and will be there after death. Right? We look at a dead body and we saw something has changed. Something is no longer there. What is that? This mind is intrinsically pure. When we are born, it is not newly created, and when we die, it does not perish. It has no distinction of male or female, nor has it coloration of good or bad. It cannot be compared with anything. It is beyond intellectual knowing, therefore it is called Buddha nature. Yet countless thoughts issue from the self-nature as waves arise in the ocean, or as images are reflected in the mirror. If you want to realize your own mind, you must first of all look into the source from which thoughts flow. Sound familiar? Okay. Because what did he just say? After this wonderful description of true nature, he said, yet countless thoughts issue from this self-nature as waves arise in the ocean or as images are reflected in a mirror. So, how do you get there? Well, he's giving us the trail. Right? Can you see that? He's giving us the trail. It's like Hansel and Gretel. Remember? How do you get home? Follow the crumbs. Right? How do you, how can I get it, how can I break into it? How can I get into it? Because it's not apparent to me. Watch. Thoughts are issuing from it. How do I go deep into the ocean? Well, you see the waves? Just go down. Because the waves in the ocean are not different, are they? We use words and say waves and ocean. Right? We create duality, we create separation where there is none. The waves and the ocean are the same, just different aspects of the same thing. Right? Thoughts are readily apparent to us. But that from which thoughts issue is not. Why? Because what have we been attending to all our life? Thoughts. That is why we spent last night, and we need to spend months and years, looking deeply into the nature of thought. What is a thought? Where does it come from? Right? We think that we talk yesterday. We think they're linked together. Right? That's how we make our history. That's how we string memory together, and we create the illusion that, that we are our story of who we are. But if you look at the process, you will see that one thought, there is a space, a gap before the next thought arises. And as your meditation deepens, you will see that gap and you will see they are not related. There is a space. And that space is what he's saying to look into. First of all, you must look into the source from which thoughts flow. Sleeping and working, standing and sitting, profoundly ask yourself, what is my own mind? Or who am I? Or what am I? Or what is my original face before my parents were born? Right? But where do thoughts come from? Right? These are all questioning that move us in a direction which is what? Inside, into the mind. That's where we need to look. Usually we look where? We look out. Yeah. Why do we meditate on impermanence? Why do we meditate on the composite nature of all phenomena? Why do we meditate on the suffering in all composite things? You know why? So when we see clearly, we will break our what? Attraction, aversion, addiction to always being caught up in phenomena. Right? Thoughts are mental phenomena. Right? And the same way, we are incessantly involved in the things of the world, the activities of the world. Right? That is our total preoccupation. You know, when we're not preoccupied with that, you know, we're preoccupied with our self-created drama about that. No wonder we do not perceive our true nature. Right? How could we? We're too busy keeping track of phenomena. I mean, it is kind of humorous, isn't it? Tragic humorous, different. But that's kind of it. So, you know, what these teachings are trying to do are trying to get us to, you know, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, stop, look deeply. But as long as we're fascinated, as long as we're attracted to the display, we'll never stop and look deeply. As long as we're totally involved in thoughts and thinking they're real and thinking that what they're telling us about reality is true, we will never look under them to see what's there. You may be surprised to postulate that there is an inherent way of knowing, inherent kind of wisdom and a way of knowing that is inherent in our mind that has nothing to do with thinking. Do you have to, call it an apple before you know what this is? You take a bite, you can blindfold you and you take a bite and you know. You don't have to, you know, saying apple or not apple doesn't mean anything. You know what it is. Right? You know, people who have dementia or Alzheimer's, they still may have knowing. They just don't have words. Right? You know, do you ever know that? Especially people getting old. Right? You know. They know you, but they don't know your name. They've forgotten how to call you son or, you know, but they still know you until it really deteriorates. But, you know, it's interesting. The knowing is still there. It's just the labeling and the construct is no longer accessible. It's too bad we make a big deal about it. And they, you know, and that they suffer and we make them suffer because, you know. Oh, you know, people are always going, don't you remember my name? You're driving these poor old people crazy. You know? Yeah. Right? And you know me. I know you. Isn't that enough? No, we want you to tell me my name. Oh, come on, how are we related? Torturing these poor people. Sleeping and working, standing and sitting, profoundly ask yourself, what is my own mind? With an intense yearning to resolve this question. This is called training, or practice, or desire for truth, or thirst for realization. What is termed zazen? I mean, zazen is dhyana, that's the single point of concentration. It's the Japanese word. So we say, what is termed meditation is no more than looking into one's own mind. It is better to search your own mind devotedly and to read and recite innumerable sutras and mantras every day for countless years. Such endeavors, which are but formalities, produce some merit. But this merit expires, and again you must experience the sufferings. Because searching one's own mind leads ultimately to enlightenment, this practice is a prerequisite to becoming a Buddha. So, we ask questions. Questions that move our attention and our awareness in a certain direction. Right? Such as, what is the thought? Where do thoughts come from? Where do they go? And the question he asks is, what is my mind? That's a wonderful question. Because most people, when you say, who are you? They'll say, I'm a body and a mind, right? And as we've done the last few days, it is people say, it becomes sort of obvious, right, that whoever they are is not in their body. So most people will settle on what? Well, I'm my mind. Okay. What's a mind? Forgive me for asking. You're a mind. What's a mind? It's inside there. Okay, okay. Can you just turn your attention inside to where you think this thing called the mind is and tell me what you see? Can you find something called the mind? Right? And the teacher will say, well, how big is it? Because if it's a thing, it has to have some kind of definition. How big is it? How small is it? Right? What color is it? Does it have a beginning and an end? Did it start somewhere and end there? So, questions. To break us out of our conceptualization about what we think a mind is to actually experience, is there such a thing as a mind? And then even deeper, what are the real characteristics? And please understand, when we talk about mind, we are not distinguishing in Zen between small mind and big mind. Right? It's only one mind. Sometimes it is called one mind. Right? And the thinking and conceptualizing aspect of mind, as we just said, are simply the waves on Buddha mind. It is not something separate from you. Actually, in truth, right now, as you sit here listening and looking, that is your Buddha mind, totally active, totally present. And all you need to do is become aware of that. To turn your attention to that awareness which fills this room. Right? People say, my mind's inside my brain. You know, that one drives you crazy. Something we've read about or seen pictures of. That's not our experience, right? This mind is not bound by outside and inside, right? This awareness is not bound by anything. It travels around the room, it goes outside. It's able to be aware of thoughts, it's able to be aware of feelings, it's able to see objects, hear sounds. It has a mysterious power. When you look into your mind, look deeply and see, can I find where it begins? Right? Do you remember the time when your mind didn't exist? I mean, if it's a thing, it had to begin somewhere, right? Can you remember a time when you weren't aware? An awareness, this awareness that we're all participating in, right? Can you define it in any way? You can't say anything about it, and yet here it is. Anytime you define it, you're defining it in what? Words. Right? And you learn words. You actually came into this world babbling. You didn't know a word. But then somebody said, your name is G. chin. Oh, that's what I'm supposed to call this. And my name is Fred. Right? And so subject-object gets reified. Right? Those are Jim's toys. Jim goes, oh, because I don't have to share. Maybe I can get some more. He looks over at the other kid's toys. He goes, maybe when Susan stops looking, I can grab one of hers. Make it mine. Because I'm a Jim. I'm separate. Imagine a child sleeping next to its parents and dreaming it is being beaten or is painfully sick. The parent cannot help the child no matter how much it suffers, for one cannot enter the dreaming mind of another. If the child could awaken itself, automatically, instantaneously, it would be free of its suffering. In the same way, one who realizes his own, her own mind, instantly frees oneself from the sufferings arising from the ignorance of the law of ceaseless change within birth and death. If a Buddha could prevent it, do you think he would allow even one sentient being to fall into the realm of suffering? Do you get the analogy? When we are dreaming the dream of self, when we are dreaming the dream of separation, disconnection, subject-object, all created by thought, and again, dreams are mentally created images. I mean, dreams are not that far away from our reality, right? So when we dream, there's often a sense of self present. There are often other people and situations. And interesting enough, in dreams, we have senses, right? In dreams, we can smell things. We can see things, we can hear things, we can taste things. So anybody who says, the sense consciousnesses are only attached to the organ, have never dreamed. So dreams, in certain ways, are very lifelike. Right? And most people, when they're in a dream, think it's real, don't you? Yeah. The drama of the dream seems very real. And then you wake up and you realize what? Oh, I was dreaming. And, if you're not somebody who just, carries a dream with you, instantaneously the drama and the emotionality of what you experience is gone. The fear, the sadness, the loss, whatever your drama you were lost in, instantaneously disappears. Why? Because you've woken up. You now see what reality is. In the same way, when you wake up from the dream of thoughts being real and the dream of separation, the dream of duality, okay? You know, I and you, those are thoughts. And they can only exist if there's an I who thinks he's separate from everything, defining himself and you. When that disappears, separation disappears, right? Somebody was asking me the other day about, how come in retreat we don't talk about our relationship with nature and the natural world? And I explained, this is a retreat. This is what we're dealing with for Vipassana. But when the disconnection and the separation and the self-absorption is no longer the modus operandi of how we act, then our oneness and our interconnection with everything is it's not something you've got to work at. Right? The robins don't work at being part of nature. Do they? I mean, it's interesting. We go, oh, look at the natural world. The birds, the squirrels, I mean, like, do they know they're part of the natural world? Did anybody ever tell them that? No. They are the natural world. We are the natural world. And we're no different. Except we have this thinking mind that discriminates its selfhood. So it sees itself as separate from all that. Right? So we see the natural world as something different than us. So in that way, squirrels and robins and et cetera have a little bit up on us in terms of their connection, their interconnection, their interbeing. But human beings, and we've got ourselves into this predicament. We've taken this marvelous tool, right? This magical tool of thought, of introspection, of contemplation, of, you know, all that, you know, and turned it into our own prison. Right? And what the teachings are trying to do are now using, you know, the words to get us back home. Right? The words took us away from our true nature, and now Buddhas and patriarchs and masters and teachers use words. It's like the cookie crumbs to show us the way home. Because we can't find home on our own, can we? We've lost our connection with our true nature. In these letters, it's interesting how he deals with people. Always with that pushing them into inquiry. So this is a man from Kumasaka. And he begins, this is Basui's response to him. Again, we don't have the letters that they wrote, so we can only suppose what they said. You asked me to write you how to practice Zen on your ship. So, if somebody was sick and asked you, how should I practice on since I'm sick, what might you say to them? What would you say to them, Andy?
Andy?
Andy. He knows his name. What would you say? So somebody says, Andy, I'm sick, home in bed, probably going to be here for weeks. You know, how should I practice while I'm sick?
Watch the mind or go while you're laying in bed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Just be sick? Somebody else might say, meditate on the suffering of the body, right? Meditate on the five remembrances, on dukkha, right? Meditate on impermanence, right? There are lots of good things, right, that as good Buddhists we might say to them, right? Use it to deepen your compassion. You know, so many people are sick, right? Experience your own sickness and use that as a way to develop your empathy for all the people who are sick. Right? You know, so there are many, we could go on and on, there are many good things that we could say. So let's see what old Basui said to the man from Kumasaka. He says, you asked me to write you how to practice Zen on your sickbed. Who is he that is sick? Who is he that is practicing Zen? Do you know who you are? So he goes right to it. All right. Who's asking? Right away he turns it around. Right. We go out, we're looking for something. Right. Give me a teaching. Right. Give me a teaching. Give me a practice. I'm sick. And Basui goes, what is that is asking? Now, why is he doing that? Is he just busy and doesn't want to be bothered? I'll just give him my stock phrase, That always shuts them up, you know. No. He's a master who teaches the direct path. Not all teachers do. You know, all the other things we talked about were all good teachers. And many teachers would do them, and that could be helpful. But he's a master of the direct path. He, you know, it's like, bingo. Who's asking? Forces you to what? Where is this question coming from? Where? In my own mind. What is my, you know? Who is it? Who is he that is sick? Who is he that is practicing Zen? Do you know who you are? One's whole being is Buddha nature. One's whole being is the great way. The substance of the way is inherently immaculate and transcends all form. Is there any sickness in your true nature? And this is kind of a famous analogy. He writes, he said, once a man was invited to his friend's home. As he was about to drink a cup of wine offered to him, he believed he saw a baby snake inside his cup. This is actually from one of the sutras. So the man offered a cup of wine. As he looks in the wine, he sees a little baby snake. Now, wishing to embarrass his host by drawing attention to it, he bravely swallows it. Upon turning home, he felt severe pains in his stomach. Many remedies were applied, but in vain, and the man, now grievously ill, he felt he was about to die. He obviously had drunk just for the sake of not wanting to embarrass his host and social convention, believed he had drunk a poisonous snake. His friend, hearing of condition, asked him to please come once more to his house. Seating his sick friend in the same place, he again offered him a cup of wine, telling him it was medicine. As the ailing man raised his cup to drink, once again he saw a baby snake in it. This time, he was done with social convention. So this time, he showed his host, look, there's a snake in the cup you just offered me. Without a word, the host pointed to the ceiling above the guest, where a bough hung. Right? Suddenly, the sick man realized that the quote-unquote baby snake was a reflection of the hanging bough. Bough, like a bough. Both men looked at each other and laughed. The pain of the sick man vanished instantly, and he recovered his health. Now, interestingly enough, we know that through the practice of insight, through the practice of deep looking, people have kind of aha experience. And often that aha experience is followed by laughter. And maybe some of you have had those kind of experiences, right? I mean, forget about full enlightenment and everything else, but sometimes you might have been very absorbed in something, caught up in something, and then something happens that reveals how, you know, you misinterpreted the whole thing, right? I was so bent out of shape that I thought this was this, 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 this. You know, and it wasn't that way at all, and you kind of laugh at yourself. How silly I was to make such a big deal about nothing, right? Or you have a big worry. And then when all of a sudden something happens and you realize that your worry was unfounded, you just laugh. One, because it was funny, but also because you're what? Relieved. And what? A great weight. You know, you feel lighter, a great weight. You know, a minute ago you were so concerned, right? You have something going on inside you, you go to the doctor and say, oh, we got to get a little biopsy on this, right? For the next 5 days, you're all you can think about is death, right? You've already said goodbye to everybody. You've already, you've imagined your funeral. You know what I mean? You've just been way down, right? There are probably people who can identify with this one, right? And then you go to the doctor, and the doctor says, no, nothing. Test came back negative. Instantaneously, you feel what? What a relief, you know. And you might even laugh. God, you can't believe, you might say, you know. But what's been going on with me the last 5 days, right? I've just been, just totally, you know, I'd already decided, you know, who's going to get what possessions. And I made arrangements who was going to take care of my children. And I've already picked out a new wife for my husband. You know what I mean? Like, I already, right? All based on what? A misperception of reality. This is, again, I mean, it's a good story because, but not only did he misperceive the situation, but he so believed that it was true, and because it was physical, he actually got very sick. Huh? And he was taking medicines. It is so effective. Living in the delusion, in the dream of self, causes us to suffer. Huh? And many of us take medicine to alleviate our suffering. In our society, we take lots of medicine to deal with our sadnesses, our losses, our fears. We take lots of medicine. But if you look at the central construct of the drama, it is an I. It is a self that is not getting what it wants, is afraid of what's going to happen to it, you know. Thinking it can't handle something, an I that doesn't like the way it's being perceived, an I that doesn't like its past. Right? I should have had a different past. But the past, if you look deeply into the past, you will see what? Past thoughts are gone. They no longer exist. Right. And the ruminations on the past are disconnected thoughts in which there is space. They are not, you know, a connected story. We make the connection. And all that exists from your past, no matter how traumatic it was, is how it's affected you in the present. It doesn't mean that there's not healing that has to go on in the present in terms of what is you're experiencing right now. But, you know, your past is gone. It is gone. And as David has pointed out, it may exist as a memory, but it doesn't exist as a reality. It's just a thought. It's just an image. You know? You may have a photograph album of all your dead relatives, right? Genealogy expert. But you would acknowledge that they're dead. They're gone. And we may have memories of them, and we may think about them, but that doesn't mean that they're alive. They're dead. They're gone. As well as all our thoughts and experiences. And that's just the truth. Our worries about the future, our fantasies about the future, what's going to happen to me if this happens, what's going to happen if that happens. None of that's real. It's all fantasy. What links all these thoughts together of past and present and future? A self that connects dots that aren't connected, that makes real what's not real. How real is a dream? You go, not real, right? Within the dream, it seems real, but I know it's not real, because the dream is just made up of mind stuff. What are thoughts made up of? Mind stuff. Right? Can anybody go into their mind, grab a thought, and take it out and say, here's a thought? I mean, I've been up in that room asking people, what's a thought? And these are people who've been thinking nonstop for 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years. And you ask him, what is the thought? They look at you. I don't know. not only have we been thinking for that time, but the thoughts have been running our life. We get happy when we have happy thoughts. We get scared when we have scared thoughts. We get angry when we have angry thoughts. We get hurt when we have hurt thoughts, right? Endlessly. And you say, well, what is a thought? By the way, what's a thought? Sure, I never thought about that. Well, I'll tell you something, friends, dear friends, brothers and sisters. If my life was controlled by something, I'd certainly want to know whether it was real or not real. Wouldn't you? Yeah? You know, just because you hear a voice in your head doesn't mean it's giving you good advice. You know, where's that voice coming from? And if you look deeper, you know what you'll say? I don't know. It just appears. I mean, come on, guys. Friends, Dharma friends. You know, people who hear voices and then do what the voices say are Baker acted in the state of Florida. Right? Right? Yeah. Just because we hear a voice telling us something about something does not mean it's real and that its perception of reality is accurate. And if we don't stop and look deeply, we will just continue to be driven by these historical voices, these historical methods, these thoughts. Right? We will continue to respond and react in the endless way we have. So the Buddhists and the teachers tell us to what? Stop and look deeply. And the Master Basui, the master of the direct path, just cuts through it all and says, what is your mind? Who is it that's asking? Because he says, who is it asking? Most people say, well, so who's asking? It must be my mind, because I know my body is just a mouth, so I know if I'm dead, the body won't say anything, so it must be my mind, right? That's talking. Okay, what's a mind? Who's talking? You might say, me. That's a good answer. Who's talking? Me. Who just said that? Me. You know, is there a me? Turn around, look in your mind, can you find something called me? And you look and you can't find a trace of anything. And yet we go and say, me. You know what that's called, my friends? Delusion. Ignorance. Ignorance of what? Ignorance of the way things really are. But luckily we have good teachings that help us see the way things really are. Both as a conceptually, so we can straighten out our thinking process and see more clearly, but also as a meditative path, so we can experience things directly and have real experience that is transformative. I was saying to somebody not too long ago, philosophy departments, comparative religions department, are not filled with happy, enlightened people. Why is that? Why is that? Because intellectual learning is not transformative. Experience is transformative. Doesn't mean, you know, they could probably people be sitting up here teaching Buddhism much better than me. You know the 10 of this and the 15 of that and the 25 of that. But do they know their own mind? Have they uprooted their own kleshas? Are they free of afflictive emotions? You know? Are they loving people, kind people, selfless people? I mean, my experience with history departments are not, it's not filled with those kinds of people necessarily. Or comparative religious people. Because they don't practice. We have to practice. That's the difference. That's why we're here, crossing our legs, dealing with the discomfort. That's why we're here, looking into our minds, dealing with the mental discomfort of taking this monkey mind and beginning to get it focused in areas that it needs to be focused so we can free ourselves. It's hard work. Yes.
The description that you gave of thoughts being things that are disconnected, that we're connecting, the word possibilities came to mind, that what we're creating, that we're calling thoughts and stories, are possibilities in contrast to the reality. Does that make sense?
Again, what we want to do here, Barbara, is look directly at a thought. Don't think about it. But in your meditation, look directly, turn that mirror mind, right? It's like the mind's a mirror and you're seeing a thought, right? And you're going, what is this? But as a phenomenon, right? There's no content, there's no interpretation. This is phenomenological description. This is what this is. So there are all different ways of thinking about thoughts, but I'm just going basically as a phenomena. What is a thought? Okay? So this is like, you know, we want to get to the very basis of it. Right? So we know that somehow the building blocks of drama, the building blocks of perception, the building blocks of labeling, etc., right, all come from thought. I is a thought, you is a thought, me is a thought, past is a thought, present is a thought, right? So we want to then ask ourselves, well, what is this basic building block of mental experience? Is it solid? Does it last? What happens when we look, you know, we say past thought is gone, future thought has become, present thought, what is a present? What happens when you try to grab onto a present thought and just look at it? Has anybody ever tried that? What happens? What happens? Poof. So you say poof, anybody else poof? Poof, 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 poof. That's science. That's replicable, right? For the scientists, that's replicable. Right? And there are certain kind of dimensions of doing a scientific experience. When you go around the room and everybody's the same experience, you go, it's replicable. It seems to be there's some subjective truth that everyone who's experienced it says, yeah, that's what I experienced. Okay? There's a truth here. And again, it's not just a truth for the sake of truth. It's a truth because it's the sake of liberation, because it is our thoughts that lead us around. Right? Like the, so what I'm doing. You know, like the ox, you know, has got the water buffalo has got the ring through its nose and just being pulled along. Right? You go to Asia, you see, you know, little 5-year-old kids pulling along this big 1,000-pound, 2,000, I don't know how many thousand of those big water buffaloes. Why? It's got that ring through its nose, a little tug, and that poor thing is coming. That's who we are. Thoughts take us here, our thoughts lead us there, we're all over the place. Right? Everybody's observed their mind, knows about how all over the place we get. Yes.
Fred, when you encourage us at the end of the day to wake up and resume our body breath, and when you say one of the three elements, to seek liberation is the determination that we carry. That is, there appears to be some continuity to that, even if it's a recreation from one time to the next. Is that not a thought that continues?
Well, again, if I said to you, if you're looking at your determination of thought, I mean, is it there all the time? your determination? And where does it go when it's not there? And you would say what?
It comes and it goes.
And practice, right, is the process of nurturing those things we want to come more often. Right? As we say, you know, spiritual practice is about becoming more conscious in our lives, right? To live life from intention rather than from history. If we live life by our conditioning, we will always continue to live the same life, right? But we're trying to kind of recondition ourselves so we live more consciously. So now we're trying to live from our intention, how I want to be, right? You know, I'm driven to be totally selfish by my trade, by upbringing, right? Total narcissist, right? But somehow along the way, I figured out, you know, that just creates a mess in all directions, right? So I'm trying to, you know, I'm looking deeply into that narcissism, to the root of it, and I'm trying to retrain myself to live more in line with a, you know, a different kind of way of living. Right? Now, my conditioning is always pushing me in the direction of what? Narcissism. So it's only my conscious intention and determination to maintain that position that begins to move me differently. Right? Now, that is why, and again, I'm going to stop now, that's almost like I talk about. You know, again, you've heard me say, that is why it is said in our tradition, practice begins with the second thought. Okay? First thought, as you might have noticed, those of you watching your mind, just comes in. Right? You have no control over that. A thought arises. What you do next, it's like what you do next, that's where practice comes in. Right? Do you link that first thought to the next thought? Or do you just let it go? Right? You can't stop the first one. As anybody watch their mind knows, they just appear. Right? They just appear. The impulse just comes. Right? Practice is what you do then. If you think practice is about not having those impulses and not having those thoughts, you will be very frustrated. Right? Many people get, you know, I'm sick of these thoughts arising. I'm sick of always having the same impulse, the same, you know. We've been doing it for, you know, a long time. That is our conditioning. And it will just continue for a long time. But during that process, we are doing two things. We are no longer, feeding the beast, as they say. We're going to stop feeding the beast. So it doesn't keep growing and maybe it starts to shrink. And at the same time, we are cultivating something else. Okay, then we've got to stop, but I've got to talk about something else. Would you really make it quick?
I think the one fear that comes out of this is your premise is that delusion. I think a fear that...
The premise what?
Well, that the current way that we see the world is delusion.
Well, I'm just speaking generally. I mean, each of us have decided how delusional we are.
Right.
Okay. I mean, I'm not... Okay? I don't know. I mean, I'm giving a Dharma talk. I'm speaking generally.
No, I think there's a fear that is to shift that delusional frame of mind. I was delusional by thinking there's some other illusion, and so I think there's that inherent kind of, you know, we're going from, so, you know, just to take for example, you know, right now, talking to you, Fred, is the sound coming towards you, is that sound even real?
Real in any self-existent, permanent way? Absolutely not.
Is it real to you?
Real... Hold on. Real is a word. Mm-hmm. Would you agree?
Sure.
Okay. If you're saying to me, when you speak, mm-hmm. can I hear? Is there hearing? I mean, even say, I hear. Is there hearing? Yes. I am not deaf. So what are you worried about? You will still hear after full enlightenment. And you'll still be able to speak. Don't worry.
So there's not even a question of real, because how do you sense the word?
Again,
how do you really define real?
Yeah, let's not get into all that. Again, you know, people often say, well, isn't, you know, all this Buddhist stuff, isn't this kind of, you know, thoughts and structures, and, you know, I thought, you know, Zen or something, that has nothing to do with any of that. And again, it's like we talked yesterday. We're on this shore. We want to get to this shore. Right? We need a raft. Okay? The Dharma teachings, the practices are a raft. Once you get to the shore, you don't need the raft anymore. Okay? So it's like you said, at a certain, you know, are we changing the way we're viewing things? Right? When I say now I see things as impermanent, when I used to see them as permanent, when I see things as composite as opposed to solid, yes. Right? You could still say that's still a view. From a normal point of view, we'd say it is now a correct view because I'm seeing things as they really are. But it's still a view. Right. Is there something beyond it? Yes, there is. Direct intuitive understanding that is transformative. Right. When you see it from the inside. Emptiness can be a concept, but emptiness means that everything is empty. There's nothing, so nothing has to be named, nothing has to be labeled. When one is quite willing to live in a world where one just knows things as they are. But, you know, but before we get there, we may have to straighten some things out. That's what practice is about. You know, so Basuri, in one of his letters, doesn't say, you know, beginners don't study sutras. He says, yeah, beginners, they should study sutras because it, you know, but please understand the sutras are all pointing to your one mind. At some point, you have to put your sutras down and come to the same realization because the sutras all come from the Buddha mind of the Buddha, his teaching. Coming from his realization, right. But in the beginning, the teachings and the sutras kind of help us kind of understand things, so we get a more correct view, right? So as Jim was saying, you know, he's not ready to get to Paris yet, right? But he's willing to entertain it and begin to, you know, plan for it by, you know, getting maps, finding timetables, right? Right? Reading guidebooks about, you know, that's kind of helping him get there. Right? He's setting intention and he's doing things that are, you know, but at some point, right, you have to leave Land O'Lakes, get out of the Tampa airport, get on the plane, and go to a place where they don't speak English. Right? Again, it doesn't mean, you know, studying French and learning about French customs, whatever, he may not find helpful when he gets to France. He may. But still, the experience of being there is can be different than being in a French class. Anyhow. Switch gears. Traditionally, on the last morning of retreat, instead of our chanting service, we either have a recitation or a transmission of the Three Refuges and the Five Mindfulness Trainings. I know that a number of you here have taken transmission, but there may be people who haven't, so I'm speaking to you. I don't know everybody here, and I don't know... what does that mean? Going back to the time of the Buddha, when people came to the Buddha and said, you know, I want a more formal way to acknowledge that I am your follower, right? You know, what should I do? That kind of ritual or... Yeah, like a ritual, but kind of a thing that marks the transition into the Buddhist family, into being a disciple, a follower of the Buddha. Not to be a Buddhist, but to be a follower of the Buddha, a student of the Buddha. And the Buddha said, please recite. And again, in those days, he would be the one administering it. Please take the three refuges. And what's called the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, the five mindfulness trainings, are called in the rest of Buddhism the five precepts. Okay? And the three refuges are, take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And then the five precepts of mindfulness trainings have to do with not killing or ahimsa, not stealing, right speech, no longer to misuse or abuse intoxicants, and to no longer abuse or misuse sexuality. So those are the five precepts. And so traditionally, when one wants to more formally connect with the Buddhist tradition and with the Buddhist teacher, one receives the three refuges and the five mindfulness trainings or precepts from them. Okay? In formal Buddhism, meaning within the larger family of the Buddha, it is called, and you'll see these in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, at the tradition, I'll talk about the fourfold Sangha. The Thich Nhat Hanh talk about the fourfold Sangha. The fourfold Sangha means it is a Sangha made up of monks and nuns, laymen and laywomen. Those are the four folds of the ordinary Buddhist Sangha. So when one receives the three refuges and the five mindfulness trainings, really that is called lay ordination. And in traditional terms, you are now an upasaka, upasika, male, female, which just denotes that you are now have formally entered the Buddhist family and are making the commitment to do one's best to live according to the three refuges and the five mindfulness trainings. Obviously, the five mindfulness trainings denote conduct, how we conduct ourselves. And really have to do with the transformation of karma. We want to stop doing things that cause suffering. And the five mindfulness trainings, the precepts, deal with those things in which we get ourselves and everybody else around us into most trouble. Whether it's some violence and harming ourselves or other people, whether it's a lying and deceiving, whether it is sexual misconduct or alcohol or drug abuse, or whether it's through our wrong speech, using words that cause suffering and harm to ourselves or others. This is the way that we keep the wheel of our own negative karma alive. So by receiving the five precepts trainings, we're trying to put an end to that, or at least a beginning to an end. Three refuges, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, they have lots of different meanings. It does not, to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, it doesn't mean that, you know, it's not like an article of faith that you have to give up everything else. Right? So it doesn't mean, you know, if there are other things that move you religiously, spiritually, you know, that one can no longer go to them or have interest in them. But it does mean that in my spiritual development, in my transformation, I am going to primarily take my teaching, my inspiration from the Buddhas and the masters and the teachers, from their teaching and from their meditation practices, and that I'm really going to take refuge in the community of the practitioners, the followers, to support me in my practice. So again, tomorrow morning, if there are people who want to receive transmission of the five mindfulness trainings and three refuges, we will have a transmission ceremony. And if not, we will just have a recitation of the five precepts. Okay? Are there any questions? And do we have a Plum Village Chaining book around? We must have some. Can we leave one out here so if people want to take a look at more at the ceremony and what the three refuges and five mindfulness trainings are, you can do it. Again, when you look at the five mindfulness trainings and you look at them, you go, Well, I can't practice all of those right now. Again, if you could practice them all right now, there'd be no reason for you to take them. Right? You take them from where you are, but with the commitment that you will bring your life more and more in tune with them. You use them now as your guideposts, right, to your conduct. I think some other questions people have. If you have taken refuge in another tradition, can you take it in this tradition? Of course. It's not limited, it doesn't say you can only take it once. Many people, in the course of their practice over many years, may move from one Buddhist tradition to another Buddhist tradition, and may move from one teacher to another teacher, and to want to create a connection through that process is acceptable. There may be people also here who have received ordination in the past, whether here or in another tradition, that may feel it has lapsed through lack of practice. And in which case, if you want to kind of re-up, you can too. And then I'll take questions. If you do want to receive transmission tomorrow, please put your name in the bell, your name, your email address, and your physical address, and a short statement of your spiritual aspiration. Okay? And I say that because everybody who receives transmission will receive an ordination certificate. And one of the things that I will do in that ordination certificate is give you a Buddhist name. And it's helpful to me to understand your aspiration to choose your name. I will be officiating at the ceremony, and I will be transmitting under the authority of Thich Nhat Hanh, who ordained me. For those who want to know that. And actually, transmitting in the tradition of Lin Chi, the great, great master of Chinese Chan, from which Thich Nhat Hanh's lineage comes into Vietnam. I think he's in his lineage, I think there are 42 generations from Master Lin Chi until him. Yes, one, two.
Is it just that the middle 12 rituals will be done there, or is it something deep? Because I'm not into a ritual.
Why don't you look at the ceremony in the book? I mean, it's a ceremony because it's a public, it's within your community. If you're taking it, you're just stepping up and saying, and you want the support of your brothers and sisters. So it's a formal thing. But again, you're not offering blood. You're not having moxa burned into your skull as in some traditions the monks and nuns do. So no sacrifices. You're not going to be asked to turn over your bank account to the Florida Community of Mindfulness. And it's really, after that, it's up to you. I mean, there's nobody monitoring you afterwards. Right? There's nobody checking up on you. So does that answer your question?
Yes, but the only thing,
what?
Can all this practice, all this must not go into
this. There's no, we don't make it like we didn't ask on the application, have you taken the Buddhist precepts? It's really your own desire to more formally align yourself, connect yourself with the Buddhist tradition as a student of the Buddha. I mean, does it mean that you on your own can think of yourself in such and such? Of course. I mean, Buddhism is very free in that way. Yes? How do I come up with the Buddhist names? Again, I use that statement of your aspiration to do it. But also you will notice that in the name I give you will be the word source. And what that is, in the Thich Nhat tradition, Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, in terms of Vietnam, there is a poem that was written by the founding teacher of the lineage in Vietnam, And in that poem, you know, it's written in Chinese, and they are characters. And so, as that poem goes on, the name, like the first generation, the first word was the name, that name was in their name. That character was in their name. So, in that poem, whatever my generation was in relationship to Thich Nhat Hanh was the word true. So everybody that he ordained, the word true is in their name. Like my name given to me by him was true energy. Okay. So when I ordain people, the next character has the word source. So everybody that I give a name to has the word source in it. And it's because of that poem. Any other questions? Yes. Yes. Right, so very good. Right, so again, if you take it, let's admit, if you've taken transmission and just want to kind of re-up or rededicate or whatever, just put your name in, but not your aspiration and address and all that. So you'll be called up, but you won't get an ordination. Yeah, that's a good question. Right. So that's, again, if anybody here, again, feels it's left or they want to rededicate themselves and want to participate in the transmission ceremony, just put your name. But you don't have to put your address and your aspiration and all that. It's lunchtime. It's actually a few minutes late, so why don't we stop?